You're listening to the winning literary show, Off the Shelf Books Talk Radio, live with host Denise Turney, author of the books Long Walk Up, Portia,
Love More Over Me, Spiral,
Love Has Many Faces,
and Rosetta's Great Hope.
Turn up your dial and get ready for a blast of feature author interviews, 411 on book festivals, writing conferences, and so much more. Ready? Let's go.
Beauty begins the moment you decide to be yourself. I love that quote, and that's from Coco Chanel. Beauty begins the moment you decide to be yourself. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's been a busy Saturday morning for me. I'm telling you, I'm like rushing to get in the studio for today's show. It's a busy morning. But I want to welcome you to Off the Shelf on this May the 11th. We have a wonderful guest on deck for you. But this is Saturday before Mother's Day. And I actually helped to create a book. It starts with love. It's got history, fun facts, tidbits. You could put pictures in it, capture memories, journaling pages. All for mom. It starts with love. And you can get that at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, online, offline. I know Mother's Day is tomorrow, so if you want a copy, you'd have to get it, like, today. And the paperback and the hardback, are my favorites because the pictures are in color. And the e-book, you'd have to print it to do the journaling. But there's still time for you to get an e-book copy today, unless you want to get the mom in your life a belated gift that she can capture her memories in. Again, there's reading in there, something she can enjoy and keep for years and years and years. So happy Mother's Day to the moms out there, even the moms who the child might have preceded them out of this world, or however you became a mother. I say happy Mother's Day and a blessing to you. And now let us go and meet our very special off-the-shelf guest. And this morning's, we've been on, you guys, I say this over and over, and I cannot believe 18 years. I cannot believe we've been doing this 18 years. Started on a real radio show and then moved over to podcast. We've interviewed so many people, from filmmakers to actresses to people who've written books, who own businesses, to editors, to people who create festivals, the movie producers, New York Times bestselling authors. And now, today's special off-the-shelf guest this morning is Matt Cole. And since he was a teenager, Matt knew that he wanted to be a crime novel writer, which is pretty fascinating. Now, yet the path from wanting to be a writer to actually sitting down and writing and publishing a book wasn't straightforward for Matt or quick. So after graduating with an English degree from the University of California at Santa Barbara, he spent 30 years in sports sales, including national sales for a sports licensing firm. And during that time, Matt also managed a restaurant. He likes to stay busy. Today, he is the author of the Rick Cahill crime novel series. He got to that dream he wanted, right? And over the years, his writing has earned several awards, including the Forward Bronze Indie in the Thriller Anthony Award for Best First Novel, the San Diego Book Award for Best Mystery, the Ben Franklin Award for Best New Voice in Fiction, and the Suspense and the Shamus Award. Additionally, Matt's writings have earned finalist status for the McCavity and Lefty Awards and Derringer and McCavity Award. Check Matt Cole, C-O-Y-L-E, out online at mattcolebooks.com, and that's mattcoylebooks.com. And again, mattcoylebooks.com, mattcolebooks.com. We are absolutely honored to have Matt with us here on Off the Shelf Books this morning. Welcome to Off the Shelf, Matt.
Thanks for having me. Honored to be here. And happy Mother's Day.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And look forward to what you share. I always learn so much from every single guest. So look forward. I know our listeners do, to what you share during today's show. The first two questions I ask every guest, just to give our listeners a little background on the writers or guests before I launch into talking about their books. So to kick off today's show, Matt, would you please tell off-the-shelf listeners where you grew up and what life was like for you growing up?
Well, I grew up in San Diego, actual suburbs of San Diego called La Jolla. I have three sisters, one brother. Sadly, my brother has passed 3 years ago, but it was a pretty normal life. I was 4 out of 5. My brother was older than me, so I took a lot of abuse, but I learned how to give it back. We had a lot of fun back in the day.
Okay, San Diego. I was talking to somebody about San Francisco, how much I think it's changing. It's very expensive, but I feel like it's always been that way. How have you seen San Diego change a lot since you grew up to today?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's now the 8th largest city in the country. Traffic is horrible. We have that. But it's growing in the arts as well, and because I'm a foodie and dining, so it's a major metropolis with all that entails. It makes it fun to write about, too.
Okay. Now, when you were a kid, you wanted a teenager, you wanted to do crime novels. Was there anything else when you were young that you just imagined yourself doing when you grew up?
Of course, I thought I was going to be a professional football player, but then I stopped growing. As you mentioned, it took me a long time to decide to actually write, but it was always in the back of my mind. But, when I was a really young kid, I thought I'd be some sort of athlete. But, it was always crime writing for me, and it was a very windy path to get there, but I'm glad I finally found the way.
Okay, I want to talk just a little about that path before we start talking about your books now. Before that, though, you wanted, as a teenager, you knew you wanted to write crime novels. Who or what inspired your love for writing books?
Yeah, it goes all the way back to Agatha Christie, Conan Doyle. I read those when I was really young. I would say I was reading Agatha Christie when I was, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10. And I really liked, I think all kids at that age like the idea there's black and white, good and bad. There's puzzle pieces. That's fun. And the good guys and gals always win at the end. And then my father gave me The Simple Art of Murder by Raymond Chandler when I was, 13 or 14. And then I saw a different shade. I thought, wait a second, there's the bad guy sometimes wins. The good guy sometimes lose. And it's not all black and white. There's some gray. And so that really appealed to me, especially at that age when you're a teenager, you're kind of rebellious anyway. So I would say they're reading Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald and Dashiell Hammett probably. When I was a young teen, that probably changed my whole target for really how I wanted to write crime.
Wow. Now I want to pivot just a little bit. I have a friend whose son owned a restaurant. I don't know if he still does. He had a restaurant, a 5-star at one point in New Jersey.
Wow.
And he would always say to me, he's got to earn his chops working for the top chefs in New York City, that running a restaurant, and now I've worked in financial services, restaurants are, even when they're doing really, really well, I'm told that is a very difficult business. So when I read that you managed a restaurant, I'm like, whoa, because I've heard that is simply not an easy gig. What can you tell us briefly what it was like for you managing a restaurant?
Yeah, it is a very tough business. The margins are so small. And you mentioned that I'd gone into the sports licensing business later. Well, if you have a bunch of product in sports licensing that you can't sell, maybe at the end of the year you have a big sale and you knock all the prices down. But you can't do that with food. Food doesn't last a year. You got to sell in a couple days or you're taking a big loss. So it's a very difficult business. The margins are tight. You're generally working with a lot of younger people who maybe have different ideas of the work schedule than you do, but they're all, they're all trying to make their way. So it's a rewarding business in many ways, but it's difficult. You're dealing with a lot of different personalities, and like I said, the margins are just really, really tough. And I would say that the failure rate of I don't know the stats I used to. The failure rate of restaurants is so huge. If you make it for 2 years, you're considered success. It's a really tough business.
Wow. Yeah, I've always heard. It is really, you didn't think that. And then a lot of it is just chains now, the chain restaurants, but you wouldn't think that it. How long did you do that? And then I did want to ask you one other question before we start talking about your books, but how long did you manage a restaurant?
Well, I was in the restaurant biz for, I think, 10 years. I managed a restaurant for about 3.5. I did everything else before it in the biz. Took my English degree from college and went into the restaurant business and started washing dishes.
Now, how did you get involved in sports sales and do any sales and do any sports salesmen show up in your novels?
Let me see. I don't think any sports sales people show up in my novels. I would probably have killed them if they did. I actually went into the restaurant I was working for, the owner who started pretty much built with his bare hands. He wanted to do 20 years. He did 20 years, and then he sold it, and we were pretty much done. So this is a long time ago because I'm kind of old. So I got a job in the want ads, the newspaper. People remember what those were. And for a golf company. I actually worked in golf for 10 years for 4 different golf companies, I think. There's another volatile business. And so I did that. And then when this golf company, I all the 4 I'd worked for had either gone out of business or changed entities, been bought by somebody else. So I saw the handwriting on the wall, and I decided on the last golf company when it was going, I saw I was going to go out of business maybe before some other people did because I've been through it. I told myself, when this thing goes out of business, I'm going to write that novel that I've talked about and never done. And sure enough, the golf company went out of business, and I took 6 months to write what I thought was a book, which was really the first draft of my what became Yesterday's Echo, my first book, after many years. And right after I finished that first draft, a guy I'd worked with in golf called me and said, hey, we need somebody in sales at the sports licensing company. Can you come over? Do you want to come in and interview for the job? I said, well, you know, I will, Eric, but I finally wrote that book, so I'm sure in a matter of months I'll be, you know, I'll get an agent, she'll sell the book, I'll buy the house in La Jolla, never have to have a day job again. So I worked for Eric and the sports licensing company for 16 years.
sense of humor. I like your sense of humor.
Yeah.
So that kind of leads into my next question. I was going to ask you, were you still managing a restaurant when you started writing Yesterday's Echo? But you answered that question. You were in the golfing, and when that shut down, did you start writing Yesterday's Echo then, or that's when you finished it? You said you took 6 months to work on the book.
Well, I for years, because, you know, I had that degree in English, which helped me get me a job in the restaurant business, initially washing dishes. I always wanted to be the writer, as I mentioned. So there would be weekends when I said, this is it. I'm going to start writing the book. And I'd write for a few, you know, I'd write 5 pages, and then 6 months later, I'd write 5 more pages. So Yesterday's Echo was a long time in coming. I was, you know, playing with it for many years. But when I finally did, when that last golf company went out of business, I finally did really write. I wrote, like I said, I thought it was a book because it had 300 pages, and I wrote chapter 1 on the first page and the end on the last page. But it was, of course, a first draft and not a great one. But I did, having that time off and forcing myself to write and realizing that I was finally doing, good or bad, what I was meant to do. Whatever skills I'd been given, these were the best I had. So I was meant to write. I knew I was meant to write. So at that point, when I had to go get a job, I knew, well, I know now that I have to do this, so I have to fill in the free hours I have doing it, and I did. But it took me 10 years to get published. It took me 10 years to revise and revise and revise and get rejected, rejected, and rejected, and finally get an agent and finally get a book deal.
Wow. You know,
and then I wrote 5 books. I wrote my first 5 books while I still had a day job, which is not unusual in the mystery business. A lot of people do that.
It isn't. But, you know, a lot of people with maybe a demanding day job, they may be raising a family. They may say, I want to do it, but I just cannot see where I could find the time to actually sit down and write. What can you share, like, 2 to 3 tips with our listeners before we dive into yesterday's echo? Can you share 2 to 3 tips, since you've done it, with how they could find the time when it looks like there is none to actually write a novel that they really, really are yearning to write?
Absolutely. It doesn't – well, if you're a soul writer like me, it does take a lot of time. But you can, if you do an hour a day, you can probably write a book in a book in a, you can write a first – let's just say a first draft. You can probably write a first draft in a year if you're a somewhat fast writer. A woman that was my mentor, Carolyn Wheat, she was a public defender in New York City, and she wrote many, many books and got many awards. But she had a friend who used to take the subway to her job, and it was a pretty – I think it was like an hour and a half or so ride every day to her job. And so she sat in the back of the subway, and every day she wrote. That was her time to write, just on the subway. And she did. She was able to produce – enough work to really get started on her book. So you really just have to be – the one good thing about writing with a job, and I never did it. I didn't do it until I was out of a job, and then I realized I could do it. I had to do it, and then I got a job. But having that time off, realizing that I had to do it, was huge for me. But then I became very disciplined, and it doesn't take a huge amount of time unless you're on some schedule where I have to get this done in a year or something, my first book. But no, if you can, and when you travel, you have to ride in hotels, on planes, and things like that. But if you're really disciplined, you can do it. And and some people do it in coffee shops. I do it at home. Some people need complete quiet. Some people need clutter around them. But you really can do it. But it really takes that first step. And you have to have the discipline, and you have to write when it's hard. It's mostly hard for me. And it's ugly. It's terrible. If I only wrote when I felt good about it, I never would have gotten a book done. And that's what I was dabbling for years. Like, oh, I feel inspired. Well, inspiration is good for just a few pages. The rest is hard work, but it's rewarding, I think.
I would agree with that. And it does take discipline, but I can remember my earlier days writing, and you've got so much to juggle. I do put out more books now.
Yeah.
But when you're raising a family, you're working a job, you've got to commute, it's like, oh, my God, where do I even have the time? Sometimes it's an hour after everybody's gone to sleep, or you get up an hour earlier, or your lunch break, half of that spent working on a book. Like you said, whenever you just find the time wherever you can till you finish that novel. Now, can you give us a brief overview, Matt, of Yesterday's Echo?
Yesterday's Echo, book number one, yeah. So, ironically, Rick Cahill, my protagonist, was in the restaurant business, and he was a former cop in Santa Barbara. This is backstory. His wife was murdered. He was arrested for the murder, never tried, released but never exonerated, so he was thought for many, many years to be someone who got away with murder. Couldn't get a job as a cop anymore. He went back to his hometown of San Diego, where he went back to work, working for his best friend in the restaurant he worked in as a kid, called Muldoon's. And as he wants to stay out of the spotlight, for the first year or so in the restaurant, he worked in the back of the restaurant. He didn't want to be out in front facing the public because he had this reputation. But slowly but surely he did. And what happens in Yesterday's Echo, he meets a woman who turns out to be in distress, and he tries to help her, and she ends up getting arrested for murder, and things go terribly wrong, which is always fun.
What is his – so Rick Cahill, he's in the restaurant business, former cop, accused of murdering his wife. What's his personality like? Is he like a fun guy? Is he – really, after being a police officer, has he become very cynical? What is he like? And besides this, I guess trying to clear his name, what else drives him in his life?
I don't think I'd ever call Rick a fun guy. He does lighten up a little bit in the probably after book 4 or so. He can be dour at times. He is cynical. Well, what drives him is when his wife was murdered, he feels somewhat responsible. Not somewhat responsible. He feels responsible because He wasn't where he was supposed to be, and he was doing something he shouldn't have been doing. And she died, and he feels responsible for that death. So he feels the need to redeem himself, and that's why he helps the woman in distress. He's, how can I make up for the grave error I've made in my life, the horrible decision I made in my life that had I not made it, my wife would probably still be alive. So his what drives him is definitely the need to redeem himself, and for many years he never knew the truth about his wife. So there's also this manic need to find the truth. And after yesterday's echo, when he goes and becomes a private investigator in the books that follow, this real manic need to find the truth puts him into some very dangerous situations, and he kind of can't help himself from driving, having to find out what really happened.
Now, this was a question that came up as I was researching for your interview. He's a former cop. Why in the world? You think he'd be the last person. Why is he suspected of killing his wife? And was that something immediate that people thought on the police force and law enforcement? Oh, that really confused me. Why would he be suspected of it? Without giving a story that was really something that made me go.
That's fine. No, you don't really even that doesn't really come about until book 5 maybe. So you don't find the truth out until Lost Tomorrow. So I might be book 6 actually. He's suspected because the marriage was going in the wrong direction. A neighbor had heard this kind of seemingly violent. Violent fight. There was no physical violence, but there was maybe a thrown desk or something like that. And his whereabouts weren't, I'm not going to get into this specifically where he was. He was where he shouldn't be, and he didn't have an alibi when she died. So he was definitely, and plus, you know how it is. Yeah, they always look to the closest to the person.
Even though he used to be a cop. So introduce us to a few other major minor characters who show up in book 1 of the series, who helped keep the story moving forward.
Well, there's the major one would be Turk Muldoon. He's the owner of the restaurant Muldoon's, and he's Rick's best friend. But they actually have a falling out in the book as well, which carries over for many books. And there's a bartender named Pat who has a role in some of the books, but the major character would be Midnight, his dog, his black lab, his best friend, the only person who's really happy to see him every day. And he's around in all, I've written 10 books, he's been in every one of them. So, and he's actually played an important role in a couple of them.
Wow. The story takes place in San Diego, does it? And what time period is book 1 set in?
Well, it's all in real time for me. So book 1 was, the book came out in 2013, so it's 2013. So it's contemporary.
Okay. Had you met
No longer
always,
contemporary. It was a long time ago.
Had you always planned to turn, when you sat down to write yesterday's echo, had you always planned to turn the book into a series? And if so, why?
I didn't until I started writing it. As I mentioned, and as you mentioned, yes, I wanted to be a writer all these years. I never did any writing. I never pursued it. It was always the guilt in me that this is something that you really thought you were going to do with your life, and if you don't really give it a try, your life's going to be wasted. And so when I first started, I just had to do it out of guilt, basically, to write that first book. You know, you've got the time now. If you really been telling people that it was a way for me to avoid really pursuing a career because I was going to be a writer, and then I wasn't really writing. So my life was a bit of it was fake in many ways, or that's how I dealt with it. And so when I finally started writing, I said, I want to write a book. It's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to write a book. And then as I learned more about Rick, that I realized, wow, there's just so much more to this guy. His backstory is so dark and deep. And there's just many things to learn that if anyone wants to publish me, I definitely am going to write a series. And very happy that was a decision I made because it took me 10 years to get published. The latest book, Odyssey's End, is number 10. So I've been writing first person in one character's head for over 20 years. So Rick is like a, he's like a member of the family to me.
Oh, my God. And Siri sell well. Once people get, you get them hooked on that first one, you're going to get, they're going to stick with you, and then hopefully you keep picking up more new readers. That's a good way to sell more, is to write a book series. Now, what is happening? We're going to get to Odyssey's End, that's the latest, but I want to work up to that. What's happening in Rick Hill's life at the start of Night Tremors?
So Night Tremors, he helped this woman out in the first book, Melody Milana, and he had a first of all, I realized, wow, this is – helping people who – I was a cop. I tried to help people who needed help. I want to do this again. So he becomes a private investigator. Plus, he's had a falling out with his former boss and best friend, Turk. And so he is a private investigator. He's working for a very large, successful agency. But he's got – he's basically the divorce guy. He's the guy who does surveillance on people – that spouses think are messing around on the other spouse. He hates it. He's watching people do things they shouldn't be doing. He's very good at it, but he hates it. And his dad was a cop before him, his late father. And his boss, the guy who hired him, is he's his dad's former partner. And hey, when can I move up to something else? And, well, you're really good at this. It'll come. And so he gets an opportunity to work by himself for someone who's trying to get a convicted murderer. He was just a kid when he was convicted, 17 years old, convicted of murdering his parents by an attorney who actually, he had a kind of contentious relationship in the first book. And he ends up trying to say, they're trying to get him out of prison. And there seems to be evidence to show that he wasn't guilty. And so Rick, on his own, with his boss's okay at the beginning, to try to help get this kid out of, well, not a kid anymore, but get this seemingly innocent person out of prison. And then there's a whole tangle.
He meets this. So this was what I was going to ask you as well. So he meets this person who he's trying to get out of prison. He's now coming to this mode where he's, like, trying to save people. Is this somebody who he met while he was doing his private detective work, where people wanted him to spy on their spouses, see if they were having an affair? Is that how, again, did he come across this young – was this a teenager – that he's trying to help get out of prison, or somebody in their early 20s?
Yeah, early 20s. He was, I think he was 17 when he was arrested and tried as an adult. It was actually a lawyer that he had bumped up against in the first book. And the because there was a little bit of the things that Rick did in the first book where he helped get this woman off. So there was a little bit of publicity about him, this guy doing this. He actually took a bullet, too. So the parents of the kid had read about him, and they said, "Well, we want this guy," and so did the defendant in jail. So that's how it started. That's how they pointed toward, and they were working with this lawyer that Rick knew. That's how they pointed towards him. And there's other reasons that become apparent in the book why they chose him.
A lot of I'm listening to you as you explain. This one thing I love about this show is that the author talks more about how the story developed, how it came about and unfolded. Is I could see where him working as a private detective, all these different clients, could just help to create so many novels where something a client he worked with 10 years ago, something comes back up in current mm-hmm. time now. Is anything in the book or the books, Yesterday's Echo, Night Tremors, based on real-life events? And if not, where did you get the idea for Night Tremors?
Well, ironically, I'm glad you asked that question, because Night Tremors is really the only plot, major plot, that I took from something that happened in real life. I watch a lot of true crime. I watch Dateline and 2020 and 48 Hours. I have all my life. Well, it's not all my life because I'm older than they are. But and so there was this kid in, I think it was Pennsylvania or New Jersey. I can't remember the state. He was 17, and he was arrested, charged, convicted of murdering his parents. And on the show, this was such a popular storyline that not only did 48 Hours do it, but Dateline did it. And every year, and they would come back to it. Every year, they do an update on this guy who's in jail, and their point of view is that he was innocent, and the evidence they're giving you, it seems like he's innocent. And so every year I'd watch, I go, oh, my God, this guy's still in prison. And I'd go online, what can I do? Is there anything I can do to help this guy? And eventually he did get out of prison, but I think he was in prison for at least 15 years. So that was the idea for me, someone being wrongly convicted in prison as a young adult, the early part of their adulthood spent in prison, a horrible place. And that was the genesis for it, but then I took it the way I wanted it to go. But that is really the only – I've used subplots, kind of things in the news that may interest me, but never the main plot from something that really happened, and that was the only book I did it in.
Okay. What is tell us what Rick's relationship is with the LaJolla chief of police, Tony Moretto. What is their relationship like? And do they interact with each other a lot in Night Tremors?
In Night Tremors, probably too much for Rick's for Rick's liking. Yeah, he's a Rick's father. La Jolla is a real town, but it did not have a police force. I made that up because I wanted a small insular police force where there could be some corruption and be no civilian oversight. So I gave them their own police force, and Tony Moretti, career-driven and possibly not straight arrow, was a lieutenant who became a police chief. And Rick's father had worked for this police force, and Moretti knew him, and Rick's father had been kicked off the force. The rumor was, and it was never proven, that he had been a bad man for the mob. He'd been a bad guy. And so Moretti hates Rick, just naturally hates him. And then so when Rick gets involved in these things, that hatred comes to full force. And in Night Tremors, Moretti has reasons to think that Rick maybe did something very bad, and that he pursues him for a few books. He was fun to write.
So I have to ask you then, is Rick, I don't want to give the story away, so have you answer, is he truly trustworthy, or is he really hiding something?
He's definitely hiding things. He's someone, particularly as the books go on, he's got a good heart, but he feels like he needs to right wrongs. And his father, his late father before him, when he was going through his difficulties, said to Rick, sometimes you have to do what's right even when the law says it's wrong. And that's Rick's coda. It's something he lives by, and that gets him into trouble. And it also, as the stories go on, he's done things because he thought it was right, even though it's against the law. And we're talking violence here in some ways. And what he grapples with in later books is, am I just like the people I'm trying to bring to justice? They all think that they're doing the right, or they're doing things for their own purposes. Am I just doing things for my own purposes, or am I really following what's right? So that's a line he walks throughout the books. And there's definitely some things that only one other person knows he's done.
He's a complex character. So who is Breanne Colton, and does she only make an appearance in Dark Fishers?
Yeah, she's a fledgling country singer who hires Rick. Her husband was a cop, and he's thought to have committed suicide, and she thinks he didn't. So the police have gone; they're gone with their idea of what happened, and they're not investigating further. And so she hires Rick to investigate whether it's a suicide or not. And there is, he becomes romantically involved with her. And that story takes a lot of different twists that I didn't expect, of course, when I was writing, when I began writing. And she does not, there were many times when I thought about bringing her back, but she always in that one book. She does go on to have a successful singing career, though. But, yeah, I thought, there were many times I thought I'm bringing her back, but I did not bring her back.
Well, any special reason you want him to stay single? He's this guy, he's on his own, he's just got this dog. Like a reason? Why you didn't want to keep like this romantic interest? You thought maybe it'll really, really shift the series too much if you did that?
Well, I started when I had two rules when I first started writing way back when I was writing Yesterday's Echo. I didn't even know what it was called at the time. And the one theory, one rule was that Rick could not have no romantic interest, no sidekick. He couldn't have the Superman sidekick who'd get him out of any physical situation. He couldn't have a really wealthy sidekick who could get him out of financial situations. And he couldn't have a humorous sidekick who could lighten the mood. I really wanted the books to be dark. And thankfully, that changed when I needed another private investigator in Night Tremors, and I brought on Moira McFarland for one scene, and she started talking, and I realized I needed her for more scenes, and she ultimately became Rick's sometimes partner and best friend, so I broke that one rule. But I did want him to be lone wolf, no love interest, but he does get a love interest in Lost Tomorrows. That we can talk about when we get there, whatever you want to do. So I had a real idea how I wanted this guy to go, and then I realized, well, I've made him a real person to me, and real person things real people do have a chance to have joy in their life and sorrow, and he's had plenty of sorrow. And so I gave him a little joy. Once I gave him a friend, I thought, well, heck, he can maybe even have a girlfriend and maybe even a wife, and he ends up having a wife.
Also, which now I hadn't planned on talking about Lost Tomorrows, but since you brought that up, I definitely with Blood Truth and Odyssey's End. Would you what book? Where does that fall in the series? Is that book 4 or 5? Lost Tomorrows?
No, book 4 is Blood Truth, and that's where he finds the truth about what happened to his father. And
that one, I definitely wanted to dig into that one. I definitely wanted to. So since we're talking about Blood Truth, and I want to make a note on Lost Tomorrows, can you give us a brief synopsis of Blood Truth?
Yeah. Yeah, Blood Truth is a special book to me for a number of reasons. It's a father-son story, and ironically, I don't really have an idea what the next book's going to be about. Sometimes the ending of one book will lead to the next book. But I knew I was going to write the father. I was going to write the truth about what happened to Rick's father because it had been something, this dark cloud over all the books. And so I had planned it. And ironically, my father passed away about 2 months before I started writing it. So it was a very personal book for me, and it was a very personal book for Rick. So that book to me is with a lot of emotion in it, and even deals with an old girlfriend too. So there's a lot of emotion in it. But he ends up discovering the truth about what happened to his father, and the title is Am I, because he went into it thinking his father was someone. As a kid, he idolized his father. As a teenager, he hated him, which can happen in parental situations, family situations. And then at the end he felt sorry for him when he died of alcoholism, and he thought things he did, he saw that things he considered, he thought that maybe his father had done. And he said, am I a prisoner to my DNA? Am I a prisoner to my blood? And so he discovers the truth about his father, and also has kind of a reacquaintance with an old girlfriend and learns her journey. And so it's a special book to me. It's probably still my favorite, although I mean, I've got maybe a couple other ones that I like just as much, but it's the longest book I wrote. Go ahead.
Was he close to his father? It sounds like they weren't close. And
well,
he was
when he was younger. He completely idolized him, and then he his father got kicked off the force. He became an alcoholic. He and his mother, he and Rick's mother divorced. So he became someone he no longer had respect for and only loved in a familial way and not in the way he did as a kid. And he died when Rick was 19 and in college. But it also sent Rick on the path that he wanted to become a police officer after his father died. He didn't before that because he wanted to kind of clear the family name. I want to be the good cop because my dad was the bad cop.
Was he really was a bad?
I guess I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah. If he got kicked off the force, he
people have to read the book to find out what really happened.
Introduce us to some of the other major and minor characters who take center stage in Blood Truth.
Well, I mentioned Moira before, Moira McFarlane, who I introduced in the second book. And I was only going to have her for a couple. She's a sometime partner of Rick's. She's a private investigator. And I was only going to have her for one scene where he needed her when he was doing some surveillance, and he needed her as kind of a reason to be taking photos of her on the beach when he really wanted to take pictures of something behind her. So he needed her for that. But then she asked him a question when they're walking back to their cars. She asked him one question. I thought, oh, my God, I need her for the entire book. And in that book, I realized that she was not only essential to all books, but she was the conscience of the series. And so Moira is a huge part, even in books where she's not in a lot of scenes, there's a couple of those, but she's still a huge part of Rick's life. She's his best friend. She's like a big sister to him. Yeah, kind of this big sister, little brother relationship. And she's a lot more even keeled than he is. She pulls him back from the abyss when she can. And so she helped round out his character. And it really, I don't think if I would have introduced her, I would have made it to 10 books because I think the series would have been too dark, too dour, too internal. And she's very competent, very likable. And I said, when people see that when Rick goes out and makes these sometimes bad decisions, if Moira still cares about him, the reader will give him another chance too. So kind of how you probably know you write books, kind of something you never anticipated that happens, and it's a blessing that you can never get a plan for.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. He's such a complicated guy. And I wonder if readers really sometimes just want to know, to really get to the core of this dude, as you read these stories. Before we talk about Odyssey's End, which I definitely wanted to, when you mentioned Lost Tomorrow, is that the lighter book in the series? He has a love interest. Is that where you expose more of him without this, the painful experiences he's had that he's let shape him or harden him? Is that a book where the reader sees a softer, more gentler side of Rick in Lost Tomorrows?
Well, they do. They see a softer, more gentler side, and they also see a very dark, calculated side. I won't get into it, but he's ready to do the worst in this book. And ironically, it probably has the happiest ending of all the books I've written. There is a spoiler here, I'll say, just for effect. He gets shot in the face, but he gets the girl at the end of the book. So that's a happy ending for Rick.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, this guy. Now, is Odyssey's End, is it the last book in the series?
Well, I'm going to call it a pause. It could be. I'm going to say it could be, and it may not be. When I knew there was going to be at least a pause with this book, and I thought, well, what if I never write Rick again? Can I do him justice with the quality of book that I think that I've been able to maintain, whatever quality that is, and that I feel he deserves? Can I get him the send-off or the pause I think he deserves? So that was a challenge for me throughout. But I also realize it's probably the most personal book I've written along with Blood Truth. But personal, and I had an epiphany a couple of years ago that I think, and this is something I've thought for years, I think all writers of fiction are trying in their writing, are consciously or subconsciously trying to work something through in their life. There's something in their life that's bothering them, what they think about, or maybe it's subconscious that they're trying to work through. And I once heard Michael Connelly say that he writes about things that scare him. So for him, it's very conscious. For me, it had always been subconscious. I realized that I was writing about families, and I don't have a family. I don't have any kids, and I'm of an age now, and that's not going to happen. There's been some tragedy in my extended family's life that has left a mark on all of us, the entire family, that I won't get into, where we lost somebody very young in our family years ago. And I think that left a mark on my writing that I didn't know about, or put a mark on my writing that I hadn't even started writing yet. And I realized when I'm writing this book, oh, my God, I've been writing about families. And, you know, clearly it's something that my subconscious is working through, that I'm not going to have kids. And my subconscious is really working hard on this. And then finally, in this book, I realized, well, I'm looking it straight in the face. I realized what I've been trying to do. I'm going to embrace it. I'm going to open a vein and let it bleed out. And so that was challenging, emotional, and I guess rewarding at the end. So pretty personal book. It's a personal Rick book. It's a personal me book. So I'm glad it came when it did. If it's the last Rick, we'll say, or Rick's World, then I think it'll be a just end. And if it's not, it'll be a nice place to pause.
Okay. Can you give us a little bit, you talked a little about what goes on in it, but a little bit of a glimpse, more of a glimpse into Odyssey's
yes.
End. And this book series sounds like a definite must read, but Odyssey's End.
Thank you. Yeah, well, here's some things that happened. Something that happened to Rick. Okay, Rick has led a very physical life. He boxed Golden Gloves as a teenager. He played football from Pop Warner, which I think is probably about 10 years old, through 2 years of college football. He's had multiple concussions as a private investigator. He's led a very physical life, and then just caught up with him in Last Redemption, the eighth book, where he is pre-diagnosed with CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, the pro football disease, which is the brain trauma disease. And it leads to diminished cognitive capabilities, early dementia generally, and an early death. And so he's been pre-diagnosed. That's the only way now. They can't diagnose completely until after the patient has died. So this has happened to him, but in the meantime, he became a father. He's married. He has a child he never thought he'd have, because when he lost his first wife, he's in his 40s, and he's now a father. And however, some of the bad decisions he makes as a private investigator, this still manic need to find the truth and try to help people that need his help, but sometimes that need for redemption caused him to make bad decisions. And it's led to some violence. It's led to putting his family in danger in the past. So his wife has left him. She's taken the child. She's left him. As this book opens, he's alone. Basically, he still gets a chance to see his daughter. He wants to get back with his wife. That's his goal in life. But if he can't, the one thing he wants to do is leave a safety net for his daughter, because he knows better than anyone that life will knock you down. And when it does, he wants her to have a safety net. And he knows also he probably won't be alive for her when she really needs his help. So he's down in San Diego. His wife and daughter are up in Santa Barbara. And he's now taking the kind of cases his wife would be very upset that he's taking, because he needs a chance to get that money, make that, you know, build that net. And the perfect person who could help him build this net, but the worst person in his background, shows up on his porch at 7:30 one day. And it's somebody who tried to kill him once, saved his life once, and bartered for his life another time. But he's a dangerous man. He's a former casino owner who's thought to be clean now, but actually he's not. And he's actually in witness protection for testifying against the Russian mafia. And he asks Rick, I need you to find somebody for me, someone that they're both past. And Rick knows this is a really bad decision, because I can't trust this guy. He's dangerous, but he's offering me the kind of money that would be a huge, huge portion of that safety net for his daughter. So he takes the case, and in doing so, all he really cares about is getting back together with his family. But this taking the case makes that potentially more difficult. And in the end, all he does, he just wants to stay alive long enough to see his family one more time.
Wow.
There's a lot of little intricacies. There's a little bit of cryptocurrency in there, things like that, FBI, but that's the gist of it.
Wow. Oh, my gosh, listening to this series. So, Rick, when this series starts, he's in his early 20s. How old is he in Odyssey then? How much time has gone by?
Well, the book starts, he's really in his early 30s, but his backstory is definitely in his 20s, all the cop stuff. He is 43, I think.
Oh, okay.
I think it's, yeah, it's been about 11-year run for him. It took me 10 years to write 11 books, 11 years to write 10 books. So I try to write them in real time, so which also means for my fans and for me that Midnight is getting a lot older, his dog. And so I try to write in real time, so don't know how much longer he's going to be able to be on the page. Very sad.
Mm. Now, what have readers been saying about the Rick Cahill book series? I'm sure your feedback been changing with each book as well. What are readers telling you about the series?
Well, thankfully, they seem to like it. Some of them, it's funny, I was for my launch for Odyssey's End down here in San Diego, Warwick's Books, iconic bookstore down here in La Jolla. I generally will kind of, I'm my own warm-up. I'll sit out there before the thing starts and talk to people. It helps relax me. And so a woman asked me a question beforehand. She said to me beforehand, she goes, you know what? I had to stop reading Rick. He does some things that really bother me, and I couldn't read him anymore. And I said, oh, okay, well, I lost one there, which is kind of like I like having that walking the tightrope, that delicate balance. And then she said, but then my sister told me, you got to read the new book. And so, and she goes, well, I couldn't put it down. You know, Rick, he gets me so mad, but I had to finish. I couldn't put it down. So that's kind of the experience a lot of them have. But, no, they've grown to like him, and they really like Moira. And that happy accident of inventing Moira, I think people really care for her. And, of course, everybody likes Midnight. But I think they're hanging in there. Like, can there be some more joy in this guy's life? And can he survive all the things that have happened to him while still trying to live to his own code?
Now, congratulations on your book awards and the nominations your work received. What was it like when you heard your first novel, Yesterday's Echo, had won an award? Were you totally shocked or surprised? What was that like?
I was absolutely shocked and surprised. I'm glad you're asking. It's a fun story, or at least fun for me. So my agent actually came to the conference where they awarded the Anthony. It was in Long Beach. And she came down from the Bay Area to be there to support me. And so all day she's telling me, because it was at wasn't a dinner at this point, but it was a ceremony for it, for all these different awards. And so she said, you know, I really have a good feeling. I really think you're going to win this. I'm saying all day I'm going, no, I don't really think so, but thank you. So we're sitting there in like the second row, and they're just about to get to my category. And she says to me, you know, it really is an honor just to be nominated. So all the confidence had ebbed out of her. And I thought, well, you're right. And then when they announced my name, it was very cool. And it was cool for the fact that my agent was there, my publishers were there, and a woman who had been in my writer's group for years were there. So all these people and a lot of friends, a lot of writer friends who we've all kind of been on the same journey of trying to get published, it was really cool to have all those people in the audience. So that, for me, was very special. And it was a great night. And then my agent wanted me to walk around with the trophy, the award. So people could see it. That was kind of funny, too.
Oh, my gosh. Awesome. And congratulations again. We only have a few more minutes, but for our listeners who themselves might be writers or might want to be, what writing process do you follow? You do about a book a year. Do you create an outline first? Do you do character sketches when you're planning out your next novel? What's your writing process?
As we talked earlier, I can give a lot of advice on what you need to do to get your rear end in the seat and right. But when it comes to process, if someone followed my process, I would feel very sorry for them. I don't outline. I used to outline a little bit. I don't outline. We call it, instead of a messy process, we call it organic. So for me, and since I've been writing, I'm writing something different right now. I'm not writing Rick. But for me, since I had this character, the main thing for me was what is going on in Rick's personal life that I can take a major Rick subplot, emotionally what's going on, and there's always something going on in his life, his personal life for sure, that we're taking a case is going to make that more difficult to deal with. And sometimes they intertwine and sometimes they don't. But either way, taking a case is going to make his life more difficult, and his personal life is going to make working a case more difficult. So that's where I start. I have an idea of the ending, you know, who the bad guys are, kind of a vague idea of the ending. And I have maybe a plot point or two. There's always the inciting incident. I have that. But after that, I'm just following, but the plot builds on what's going on in Rick's personal life. It doesn't make sense. It's very messy, but it kind of works for me, and I've learned to trust it finally, to trust this very messy process. I tend to write very long, messy first drafts, and I'm putting in things. Sometimes I'll write all day a chapter that I know is not going to make the book in the end, but I need it to get to where I'm going to go. Because I learn more about the characters as I'm writing. And so it's not efficient. I don't recommend it for anybody unless your brain works that way. But I've tried to outline, and it just stunts me. It just slows me down. So I just jump in with both feet. And as I'm writing now, something different, new characters, I'm having to learn them as I go. And I tried to do all the outlining beforehand. And once again, because I thought, well, this is different. Do something new. You need to try it differently. No, I got to be messy about it. And so the advice I would give, if you found a process, trust it. Yes, it can be improved. Certainly can be improved. And each book's a little different. But trust the process. If it's got you somewhere, trust it.
I would agree with that. I like the part about writing a chapter that you know is not going to stay in, but it can help the story to move forward. We have only 2 minutes, so two things in 2 minutes. Can you share very, very quickly a few tips that you found to be effective about getting the word out about your books? That's the first question, then I have another one before we close the show.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say social media and whatever social media platform works for you. I got on it years ago before I was published. I knew that I was going to have to be a member of this community to get the word out. And what happens, and I'm Facebook, that's my demographic, those are the people. And what happens is people that you knew in high school find you, and if they think, well, this guy can't write, he was an idiot. But if they write you and like you, they will really word of mouth. You get a lot of word of mouth through social media. It is a great, and that's the way you sell books. So I would say find the one that works for you. You don't have to do them all, but social media really helps.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the book you're working on and when we can expect to see it on the market?
I can tell you what I'm working on. I don't know when we can expect to see it on the market. Right now it's tentatively called Temecula Sky. It's about a little bit of Rickland here. It's about a former cop who had to leave the force, and for different reasons than Rick did, but he's helping his father, who was also a cop, financially because he's going through some health situations, and even with social Medicare and all that, he's not able to make all the payments on what he needs. So Rick's, as a private investigator now, he's not making enough money to help his dad. So he takes a part-time job or it's a fill-in for a public defender's office, completely goes against what he believes. He's on the right, he's on this side of the law, and he's working for the other side. His dad can't stand the fact that he's doing it, but he needs to do it to get the money to help with his father's medical situation. And so he ends up working with a public defender, and there's a romance there, and he starts to see things somewhat differently, but not all differently. And the person he's working with is a true believer like him, but on the other side, so there's that dynamic. And it's a murder case they're working on, but it grows into something much larger. But oh, okay. I don't know when it'll be published. I don't know when it'll be published. I have to
sounds
get the sell
like
agent,
another
to sell
new
to a new publisher.
On the way. Where can off the shelf listeners get a copy of your books, Matt?
They're everywhere. You know, they're on local bookstores, hopefully, independent bookstores. They're at Amazon, so they're available. And they're available in all forms, too, all formats. They're available. Every book has been done audio, too, so that's cool.
We have had the pleasure. Oh, my God, is Rick Cahill, Book Series of today, interviewing Matt Cole. Matt Cole, I encourage you to visit him online, mattcolebooks.com, M-A-T-T. CoyleBooks.com, MattColeBooks.com, the Rick Cahill book series, and he's working on a new one. Oh, your book sounds so interesting. Thank you, Matt, for taking time out of your schedule to be with us on Off the Shelf Books today. And to our listeners, thank you for being here with us. Remember, set on your calendar Saturday mornings, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time or New York City time, you're going to catch Off the Shelf Books. And as I always tell you, you are awesome. You are incredible. Go out and create a fabulous day for yourself today. Rick, I'll shoot you an email with a link to the show when it finishes streaming.
Great.
Thank you so much. Bye for now.
Thank you. Thank you.